I'm Daniel Atlin. Welcome to Messy, where I have conversations with leaders about how they navigate and make sense of the mess they find themselves in. So welcome to Messy, where we make sense of leadership. I'm very pleased to introduce our guest today, Dr. Vivek Goel. Dr. Vivek Goel is the University of Waterloo's President and Vice Chancellor. Previously, he has held a number of senior leadership roles at the University of Toronto, including as Vice President and Provost, and most recently as Vice President Research and Innovation. He served as founding president and CEO of Public Health Ontario from 2008 until 2014, and as a founding scientist at the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Studies. He has served as the chief academic strategist with Coursera, a global platform that connects universities and learners with online courses. Vivek obtained his medical degree from McGill and completed postgraduate medical training in community medicine at the University of Toronto. He obtained a master's degree in community health from U of T and a master's degree in biostatistics from Harvard University School of Public Health. Thanks for joining me for this conversation, Vivek.
It's great to be here.
Fantastic. So I'm first going to start off by asking you to make a little bit of sense-making by looking backwards on your career. You've had a very interesting career bridging government, healthcare, the private sector, and of course, higher education. Would you like to talk a little bit about your leadership journey and maybe to offer some reflections on that?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be part of this podcast. And, you know, I think the title is really appropriate. Leadership has become really messy over the years. You know, my own journey, as you noted, I went to medical school. I did practice as a physician, so seeing individual patients. And I quickly came to a personal realization that I could do more for the health of my patients by keeping them from ever becoming patients. So that got me into public health. And as part of public health training, I got to learn a lot about statistics and epidemiology. I also learned about organizations and how they work. So public health is really about organizing ways to improve the health of the population. And you work at a population and policy level. And so I think those two parts of my academic preparation have really served me well as a leader, because as a physician, as a clinician, I worked at that individual level. And so how do you work with an individual patient, understand their issues, their concerns, what their family's concerns might be, and how you help address them, but also at a population level, how you work with an entire group, community. And so in my work, whether it's been in the university or in the health settings or in other settings, you know, I think I've always come at it with looking at both the individual level as well as the group or population level, and always working to try to bridge between those two levels. And so that means, you know, when you're making a decision at the population level, it's inevitably going to mean that some people will be better off, but some people may not be better off. And you have to be able to explain to those people that are not better off. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not better off in financial terms, but it could be that, as we saw during the pandemic, that everyone has to take on certain restrictions in order to benefit the population as a whole. And you may not benefit from those restrictions, but you're benefiting the population whole. If you don't explain why everyone has to incur those restrictions, you're going to wind up with grief as a leader. And so having that individual and population perspective, I think, is really critical. And that certainly served me well.
Fantastic. It's really all about, in many ways, trying to adapt systems, complex adaptive systems, and trying to make change. And you've got great experience on that you brought into university leadership as well.
But I would just say it's understanding the complex systems, but always bearing in mind that there are people inside of that system, and each of them has their own individual circumstances.
Even more messy. And as we've discussed before, I have the words of a senior academic advisor from the University of Toronto in mind often, and he shared with me about 20 years ago that leaders don't matter. And he was using this, you know, to refer to a point in time at the University of Toronto where it's just very turbulent in some ways. There was a lot of, I guess, a little bit of a revolving door in leadership churn. And you had a front seat to this. And what do you think about this statement? And do you think it has the same relevance now, almost 20 years ago?
You know, I know the time that's being referred to, and it was a very significant period of time where within a matter of months, the university lost its president, its provost, as well as a number of other vice presidents. And, you know, I remember people in our community, as well as the media, saying, this is terrible. The university is coming apart. And I know I said, I think in a media interview around that time, as well as at one of the university's governing bodies, when someone raised the concerns about the rapid transitions that had been happening at the leadership level, that, you know, the reality is the university continues to operate. The students have been admitted, they're getting taught, research is being done, grants are being submitted, everything, the usual flow of the institution will continue on. And so, you know, it's not, the university is not coming apart today as a result of all these unexpected changes in leadership. But I did note at the time that I think where we have the potential for things to go astray is when we take a long-term perspective, and that leaders do matter in helping an institution like a university make decisions around where they're going to go in the long term, what programs are going to be developed, what fields of scholarship, what new emerging fields are going to be explored, what capital developments are going to be done, what that long-term vision is going to look like. And you know, that's not like students are going to continue to get taught and research will be done, but those long-term strategic pieces won't necessarily be happening if there's a vacuum in leadership. You know, I think reflecting over the last 20 or so years, I think what's become even more important is it's not just about having the leaders for that long-term work. And I could say that, you know, it was a much more luxurious time as a leader. You could step back and really think about those long-term things while others took care of the day-to-day. But today's day and age, and I think that it is part of what's making things much messier, is leaders of all types, not just in universities, are expected to be there every time something happens, whether it's in our own community or somewhere in the world that affects our community. And, you know, I think that's in large part driven by social media and the expectations for immediate responses when things start to float out. And, you know, I think, again, for an institution like a university, if you don't have leaders, it's going to be very difficult for an institution to be able to respond in the kind of immediacy that is expected. So I think that would be a very significant change from when that senior advisor might have made that point 20 years ago.
Yeah, thanks so much. And I think you're quite right. And we've talked before as well about COVID and the nature of leadership during COVID. And without someone, I think, or voices at the top, you know, it would have been very quickly a very different situation as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So and you know, as we've stepped up a response to an emergency like that, and whether it's COVID or other situations, and we increasingly face more emergencies of different types because of what's happening in the world and with the climate crisis and so many other challenges. If decisions around do we move to teaching online are left to individual instructors to make, it's going to get quite chaotic very quickly for the institution, right? So the leadership has to come from somewhere.
Absolutely. Now, maybe actually we can talk about leadership a little bit and how strategic plans sort of fits into that. When you joined the University of Waterloo, which is a very unique university in many ways, you decided not to create a strategic plan. Now, we've discussed before some of the challenges of strategic planning. Do you want to perhaps, you know, lay out a little bit of your thoughts and strategies behind not actually going for that strategic plan?
Yeah. And this really came from some of the experiences I also had at the University of Toronto and from what I've been seeing in many other organizations play out over the last few years. I think this, first, I think we have to go back to how what people think of as strategic planning evolved over the last 50 or 60 years. And, you know, quite often the standard approach is a five-year strategic plan, often tied to the mandate of a particular leader, whether it's at the institutional level or a faculty or department level. And so terms are usually 5 years, and so people do a five-year plan. The original conceptualization for a five-year plan actually goes back to the Soviet era. And in the Soviet era, there were five-year industrial plans for the economy, and they were the five-year window was arbitrary. It was the length of time it generally took to develop a new factory from, you know, start saying we're going to build one, planning it, and you get it into operations. And so you know, here's 5 years, and then we're going to work on what we're going to do the next 5 years. And when you start to take that and you think about the work of a institution like a university, but I think for many organizations, you don't really do your work on that kind of time horizon. And so, you know, it's really about stepping back and thinking about what your long-term vision looks like. The other thing that I think was happening was that strategic planning itself became the product. You know, it's not about what where we want to head as an institution, how we hold ourselves to account on that. New leader comes in, I'm going to get a plan done. Here's the process. I'm going to produce that. Gets a nice glossy report, goes up on a website. And then by the time you're done, a couple of years later, you're starting the next plan without ever actually checking to see, have you got there? And so what we did instead of doing another 5-year strategic plan for the University of Waterloo, and this is modeled on something that, again, about 20 years ago at the University of Toronto, when David Naylor came in as the president, I was serving as provost at the time, we developed a vision for where the university was going to be by 2030. And at that time, it was about 23 years away. And, you know, the university has stuck to that vision. They've updated, they've fine-tuned, and so on. And so I also took a similar approach when I arrived at Waterloo, and it was really more around developing a long-term vision for what the university would like to be. And we chose, again, because it had a certain resonance, Waterloo at 100, where Waterloo will be by its 100th anniversary, which it'll be in 2057. So it was a little bit longer. It was about a 35-year time horizon. But as it turned out, it actually became a very productive exercise for the institution, because this was an institution that was founded in 1957 and had been in constant growth mode throughout that time, had done some very innovative things like the development of the cooperative education model. We're now the largest provider of co-op education and research intensive university in the world, about 25,000 work term placements a year. We've developed a very entrepreneurial culture with a very unique intellectual property policy. We had one of the world's first standalone faculties of environment well over 50 years ago. We have a standalone faculty of mathematics. Now everyone's working on data science initiatives or things that bring those areas together. So just to say, like, the university had grown really rapidly, had developed some very innovative things. But now, coming out of COVID, and with a lot of other sort of restrictions on the institution, provincial pressures with tuition freezes, as well as caps on domestic enrollment growth, and then the changes that happened very rapidly with international students in Canada, the institution was at an inflection point. It was moving from constant growth to flattening or even reduction. And so it really forced the question about, you know, where do we want to be as an institution? And we can't continue to just grow in the directions that come at us. And so by stepping back and with an exercise that took close to 2 years with our community and engaged really thousands of people in our community, our alumni, key stakeholders around us, we developed the vision for the university, which, you know, really it's about going back to our roots, understanding what our differentiators are. And then in parallel, we worked on, and it's something that we continue to work on, what we are referring to an integrated planning and budgeting process, where we move away from static five-year plans to rolling plans that we're constantly updating. And so every year we are looking at what our priorities are within the context of the long-term vision that we have set for ourselves. And the integration part is we look across all of our faculties and administrative units. We look across our operating and capital budgets. We look across, you know, planning for enrollments, planning for faculty complement, planning for spaces and infrastructure and IT. We bring it all together in an annual cycle. So rather than doing these things in isolation, which certainly Waterloo was doing and many institutions do, we look at them in a much more coordinated and cohesive manner. And we can assess our decisions, our what priorities we set for an annual basis, for how are they going to advance us towards the long-term vision that we have. So I do want to say it's not about wiping out or saying we're not going to do planning, but it's moving away from a very rigid and I would say archaic approach to five-year strategic plans to a much more nimble and cohesive approach to planning that ties our budget process to those planning priorities.
Well, thanks so much for that. And I agree. I think, you know, if you look backwards over the past 5 years, for instance, you know, you couldn't have predicted COVID. You couldn't have predicted, you know, the geopolitical challenges that we've faced. You certainly couldn't have predicted, you know, the backlash on international, you know, students and immigrants that we've been facing here in Canada. So creating something that's more like a strategic compass or something that's more flexible and can, you know, point to directions, as well as working on the infrastructure to make certain that you have a coordinated and integrated, you know, process and culture, makes a lot of sense. And I know you did that at U of T, so you can do that here too.
And, you know, and then if we think about on all the things that you mentioned, but just the last 6 months, how the world order has been turned upside down, right? And so being able to say, well, this is what our institution is going to continue to do well. Okay, the world is changing around us. What do we need to change in our immediate priorities so that we adapt to that, but then continue along? And I think we're going to live in a world where there'll continue to be dramatic changes on a very frequent basis. This kind of approach, I think, is going to certainly help serve Waterloo very well.
Absolutely. Well, and amongst the changes we've talked about, we didn't even talk about, you know, AI. And I know you've given AI a lot of thought, and you've been tasked with a little bit of a work by Universities Canada, I believe, on thinking about it as well. And you last week wrote an op-ed with David Agnew from Seneca Polytechnic that touched on it as well. Can you maybe speak a little bit about your initial thoughts? I'm not going to hold you to this, but speak a little bit about what you think some of the impacts are going to be in the short term and things to consider for universities.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, AI is rapidly evolving, right? And, you know, what I say today may not even be true in a week's time. But we know it's going to have a significant impact on the way in which we all work, we interact, the way in which we teach, the way in which we do research. But we can't predict exactly what that's going to be. And some things are happening very quickly. They're happening as we speak, and some things are still going to take time. And so it's preparing ourselves again for the change that's going to come. And so, you know, some of the basic things that I think are really important is ensuring AI literacy for the entire population. And it starts with our own community, like our employees, our faculty and staff, our students, for helping them to understand what AI is, what it's not, where it can help, where it can be a hindrance. Also helping to understand the social impact of potentially unchecked AI, the environmental impact related to the energy consumption, to the intellectual property issues that are very live in terms of how AI models are trained on the work of others, most often without the appropriate permissions. So there are many issues that I think as a starting point, we just need to develop more literacy. And so an educational institution like ours is obviously well-placed to lead on that. AI tools are evolving very quickly. And so we need to ensure that members of our community have access to appropriate tools. Tools aren't inappropriately taking personal or confidential information and reusing it. So we have to help our community. We have to do the due diligence just like we do on other software tools that we adopt. But we also have to get them in the hands of people so they can start to work with them and see what the potential is. A critical element for AI models is data. And that means having our data governance processes in place and moving again away from our traditional models of dealing with data, which was to silo the data. We're going to keep student information over here and personnel information and financial information. And we have different custodians for each database. But if we're really going to make effective use, we have to figure out how in appropriate ways, we bring data together so that the models can be developed in appropriate ways while preserving confidentiality and privacy of information. So, you know, I think at this stage, the important role for us at the institutional level is really making sure the conditions are right for enabling the use of AI in our community. You know, in the op-ed with David Agnew, we also talk about what our role is in helping our broader community with the adoption of these tools. And in particular for Canada, we know that there's huge potential with these sorts of tools in helping address productivity challenges. And, you know, if we don't, we know we've been falling behind as a country on productivity. And if we don't take advantage of this, we're going to continue to fall behind because other jurisdictions are going to be taking advantage of it. And it would be a shame because Canada has been such a leader in the development of many of these technologies. And in particular, you know, what we see is that there's tremendous opportunity for small and medium enterprises with AI adoption, but that's maybe where some of the greatest challenges are. How do small business owners develop the AI skills that are necessary? How do they get access to the tools, to the models that are necessary? And so I think there is a real role for universities and polytechnics and colleges to play in helping support AI adoption by those types of organizations, particularly the smaller companies. You know, the big corporations have lots of internal resources to work with on this. You know, as we look ahead, as the technologies continue to develop, I think for our institutions, there are going to be much more potentially existential questions for us to address. As AI tutors continue to develop, what will that mean for how we teach, how students learn, how we do evaluations? Because if we're using teaching to provide instruction and students are using AI to provide instructions and they're using AI to provide the answers, who's learning what? How do you assess what's been learned? Many respects, I think we're going to circle back many centuries. You know, the original Oxbridge model was an individual student went to Oxford or Cambridge. They were assigned a don or a tutor. They identified what areas they wanted to learn about. They were told, here's the things to go and read and come back and talk to me about them. And they had time to interact with their colleagues. But there wasn't a lot of structured instruction. People really learned by doing things, by being with colleagues, by having conversations. And at some point in time, the student came before an examining board, had an oral examination where a panel judged whether they were ready to earn their degree. And that's the way you knew that person had learned enough. And I think we're going to go back to probably very similar models where, you know, our students will be able to learn in all sorts of ways the knowledge they need to acquire. And our role will be to help guide them in what they should be looking at and to then help in that assessment. And so I think it's going to be a very fundamental change in the kind of roles that professors play. And on the research side, again, we're already starting to see significant transformations in areas like drug discovery. And I think just starting to scratch the surface in many other disciplines. But I think an important element is going to be, you know, going back to how do AI models get developed? The AI models that exist have been trained on the wealth of human knowledge, most of the time inappropriately, right? Sucking up all the information out there. And as we look to the future, if we don't continue to generate new knowledge, how will AI models continue to develop? And I think where we really have to start to put our minds to is what is going to be our role as institutions of knowledge generation, of knowledge preservation, knowledge transmission in the AI age. I think there is going to continue to be a very critical role, but we have to really get on with defining what that's going to be. And I will also hazard that role will, you know, we often have a focus from government on STEM education, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and certainly AI has come out of those fields. But when we look at what's actually going to be required of humans, it will likely be to come from what we would have traditionally called the liberal arts, social sciences, and humanities. We're already seeing it in co-op job placements. You know, the entry-level work is being replaced by AI tools, but employers are looking for people to praise the output from the AI. So we have to prepare our students to do that work. And the kinds of skills that I think that entails are actually the skills that would have traditionally come in a humanities or a social sciences type of preparation. And so, you know, I think there's going to be some very fundamental thinking required for us as well as for those that govern us and fund us, because I think there might be a swing back to types, very types of education that have been devalued by our governments, by our funders in recent years.
That's really a great observation, and I can see that playing out, actually. So thanks so much for that perspective. I think it gives me hope, as someone who actually is from the social sciences background, that I made a good choice, so that's good. And I can see how that would be applicable, actually, in the world of AI as well. Mm. Now, shifting gears a little bit, what advice do you have, actually, for leaders who are looking to navigate the mess of leadership, and leaders especially in, you know, these public-oriented organizations, you know, hospitals, public health agencies, universities, and colleges? What advice would you have?
You know, I think there's a few elements there. One is, and I don't think this is new, it's always been the essence of leadership, is you got to take time to listen, to understand. And the messy part is there's probably many more voices to be heard because, again, as a result of social media and the email and all the tools we have for communications, you can get a lot more information in front of a leader. So it is going to be messy. It is going to take more time. But if you don't take stock of all the different perspectives before you make a decision, before you set a direction, you're going to set yourself up for failure. Because you will not be able to explain to someone why their area or their direction has not been chosen. The, you know, I think understanding the many different forces, like as a leader, you certainly have to look at everything happening within your organization. But I think, again, if I compare it to 20 to 25 years ago, you have to pay attention to certain elements of what was going on around you, but now you got to have a full 360 understanding of everything that's going on around you as well. So, you know, listening, understanding, making sense of everything that's going on around you. So to balance that, you know, I think it's all my advice to leaders would also be, don't let things consume you, right? You got to find balance in your life. You're not going to be a good leader if all you're doing is only focused on your leadership role. And you're just going to burn out very quickly. So, you know, it's a complex world. It's a difficult world. But as I've been finding with my work on the Waterlit 100 vision, you know, the opportunity to really set direction, to work towards a common goal to address the biggest global challenges is also the payoff of being a leader in these turbulent times.
Thanks so much. And really have enjoyed this conversation, Vivek, and look forward to continuing it again in other venues as well.
Well, thank you very much.